Welcome to Trial Lawyer Talk. I'm Scott Glevsky, and I'm your host for this podcast where we speak with some of the best trial lawyers in the United States. First, today I'd like to thank our exclusive sponsor, Tracy Cass from the Settlement Alliance West. Tracy is a phenomenal settlement consultant, and I've worked exclusively with Tracy for the last 10 years because she cares. Just like the folks I interview on this podcast, she cares about the clients and does a great job. Now, at first, I was very hesitant to get a sponsor because this podcast is not about making money and it never will be. So all of the sponsorship money is going to advertise the podcast so that we can spread the word and get more listeners. So thank you, Tracy. Now, today we're very fortunate to have with us Eric Davis. Eric is a gem of a guy, phenomenal lawyer, and a wonderful teacher. He's an assistant public defender in Harris County, Texas, and truly one of the best trial lawyers I know. So let's get started. I'm very pleased to be sitting with a phenomenal trial lawyer. Eric Davis is a public defender from Houston who's handled all kinds of cases and is a tremendous, tremendous human being and has a wonderful presence and is a great storyteller. Eric, thanks for being with us.
You're welcome and thank you for having me.
Eric, is there a story of a case that profoundly impacted you?
Yes, Scott. There is a story that I recall.
Please share that with us.
Oh, several years ago when I was in private practice, I was contacted by a 78-year-old pastor. His daughter, actually, and he came to my office, and they wanted to hire me to defend him in a criminal case. He had been accused of assault and trespassing. My client was an older gentleman, 78 years old, retired veteran, and retired from being a pastor. One night he went to sleep, and he woke up, and his neighbor had moved the fence 2 feet over to the left. And so he got out and saw that his fence had been moved over and confronted his neighbor. And his neighbor said, "Man, are you crazy? Is there something wrong with you? Nobody ever moved that fence. We didn't move the fence while you were sleeping." But my client was convinced that his fence had been moved. And so he started mowing the lawn in the area where the fence was. You know, that lawn next to that area of the lawn next to the fence was his. So he began mowing it and caring for it as if it was his. His neighbors would tell him, "Get off our lawn. Stop mowing our lawn." He said, "This is my lawn." My client even hired a surveyor. And the surveyor, came out and with his survey found that that stretch of land was my client's. You know, the original survey, according to the neighbors, was that it was their land. It was the neighbor's land. So he had this dispute over this small tract of land next to his lawn, next to his fence. And he continued to take care of it if it was his. One day, after a couple of arguments with his neighbor set up some water sprinklers near that area of the lawn. And sure enough, my client went to mow the lawn as he always did. Every Thursday, he mowed that lawn. So he went to mow that lawn. And when he was mowing that lawn, pushing his lawnmower himself, and it was a self-propelled lawnmower, but when he got behind it, he had to push. And so my 78-year-old client got behind that lawnmower and started pushing it and started cutting that area of the lawn. The neighbor got up, went outside, and cut on the water sprinklers. And the water sprinklers came on and wet the client up, and wet him up so much that his cell phone was broke. Immediately, his neighbor charged outside. You know, she took care of a bunch of dogs and stuff, so she had some dogs running around with her. And so she charged outside as he's standing there wet, and he's got the water sprinkler in his hand, and she goes up to him yelling and screaming and berating him about being on her lawn, saying, "Get off my lawn, you crazy old man. You shouldn't be on my lawn, you crazy old man." And he does what any 78-year-old pastor in that situation would do. He went upside her head with the water sprinkler. And after he did that, of course, her husband came out and they argued and they called the police. And the police came out and arrested my client and charged him with assault and trespassing. And then he and his daughter came to my office. His daughter happened to have been married to a doctor, an orthopedic surgeon. And they came to my office and she said, you know, my dad wants to hire you in the case. And it was strange to me, you know, because the guy was really old, but I could tell that the elevator didn't go all the way upstairs, you know. So it was a little different, Scott. And so I'm talking to them and we're having conversation and they say, well, you know, he insists on hiring a black lawyer. He wanted to have a black lawyer. And the client tells me, says, you know, I wanted a black lawyer because your people fight. You fight. And
what nationality was he?
He was a Caucasian male. He's a Caucasian male. And so I said, okay. I didn't have a problem with that. I thought I took it as a compliment and took it in stride. And you know, I quoted him a fee. And his daughter had her checkbook out and asked me how much would I charge him. And I quoted him a fee. And so she put her checkbook back in her purse and pulled out cash and paid me in cash. And I thought, first thing I thought, man, I didn't quote enough. I didn't quote enough. She put the checkbook back. I didn't quote enough. And then she started to tell me, she says, you know, it was between you and Rusty Harden. And in the Houston area, Rusty Harden's a high-profile attorney, a very expensive lawyer. And they were considering hiring Rusty Harden or me on the case. And then I said, man, I should have added another zero to the fee. I didn't charge enough. I didn't get enough of the fee. But it was what it was, and I was committed to defending him. So I went to court on his very next court date. We hadn't yet been set for trial. And the judge called me up and said, Mr. Davis, you're on this case. And in the courtroom, we were in Judge Diane Bull's courtroom. And Judge Diane Bull was a judge who actually went to TLC. She actually went to the Trial Lawyers College. She was a judge that cared for defendants. She was a judge that really saw behind charges and really tried to look to the truth of the situation. So she tells me, she says, so you're representing this case. So you're on the case for the pastor. And I say, yeah, Judge Bull. I said, it's interesting that it came to your court. She says, it's in my court because he had gone to trial a couple years ago and had represented himself. And he was convicted in that case. And I never sentenced him. I deferred. I set his sentencing out 20 years or so. And I never intended to sentence him. And so when he was arrested on this charge, it automatically came to my court because I had that other case that he was never really, a judgment was never entered on him or anything else like that. And I was like, wow. She said, and she told me, Mr. Davis, if you can get him to agree to go to a mental facility, a mental health facility, I will convince the DAs to dismiss this case. I'll talk to them and put pressure on them to dismiss this case. If you can get him to agree to being involuntarily committed. Say, hey, he doesn't even need to be involuntarily committed. If you can get him to agree to go and see a psychiatrist and be involved with a psychiatrist, I can convince him to dismiss this case. My client was adamant that he didn't have a mental health issue. He was adamant that he was not mentally ill and had no problems with mental illness. And we were not pleading insanity. We were not doing competency evaluation because he was competent. And so we asked for a trial date. And Judge Bull gave us a trial date immediately. We got a quick trial date. And I remember doing my preparation for trial, and I remember sitting down with the client and talking to him about the case and talking to him about what would happen during a trial. So trial day came. When we went to trial, you know, the pastor wore a suit and I had dressed for trial and we showed up in court. Usually in misdemeanor court, you pick juries. And when you pick a jury, each side has an opportunity to strike four people. We can strike any four people we want. You know, and the other side can strike any four people they want as well. You don't have a huge panel, but you have people to come over on a panel. And I remember before the jury being seated, turning to my client and saying, you know, we can strike any four people we want to. No questions asked. We find out those that we don't like, those we think they're adverse to our case. And so the client turns to me and says, the Holy Spirit told me to strike the first four people. And I said, excuse me? And they said, the Holy Spirit told me to strike the first four people. I said, Pastor, we can't do that. We don't know who they are. We don't know who those people are, what they're going to say. We don't know. They could be favorable to us. They could be against us. We don't know what they're going to say. We don't know anything about them, so we can't strike them that way. He said, the Holy Spirit spoke, and the Holy Spirit told me to strike the first four people. And so I said, well, all right, I figured, you know, we can go ahead and go through with the trial, and after we see what happens with the jury, we can talk about this again in terms of which ones we strike. And sure enough, you know, we were making a claim of self-defense. And sure enough, those first four people were solidly in favor of us. They were great jurors, would be great jurors for the pastor. They were solid self-defense jurors. They were there. They were with us. And so I turned to the pastor and said, Pastor, we can't strike those people. Those people are solidly with us. Those are defense jurors all the way. We got to keep them and look at other people possibly to strike. And he told me, the Holy Spirit has spoken. Let's strike the first four people. We got to strike the first four people. So we struck the first four people. And we proceeded to the trial, And as it would have it, when we got through the trial, it came time for the pastor to testify. And the pastor took the witness stand, and as he was testifying, we were making a claim of self-defense. And so I asked him, I said, now she was charging towards you. Isn't that right, Pastor? Yes, sir, Mr. Davis. She was charging towards me. And when she's charging towards you, you were worried about your safety. Yes, sir, Mr. Davis. I was worried about my safety when she was charging towards me. And she charged towards you as she was coming out there. Isn't that right? He says, that's right. Says, you had been soaked up with a water sprinkler, and she's charging towards you, yelling at you and berating you. Isn't that right? And he says, yes, sir. That was absolutely right. She's yelling at me, berating me, calling me all kinds of names. Everything but a child of Jesus, she's calling me, and she's charging towards me. And so I said, well, Pastor, at that point in time, fearing for your safety, you hit her. Isn't that right? Well, no, Mr. Davis, I never hit a woman. I didn't hit her, Mr. Davis. I never hit a woman. I said, well, wait a second, Pastor. Now, you're saying this is self-defense, that you were defending yourself, so you had to hit her in defense of yourself. No, Mr. Davis, I didn't hit her. I never hit a woman. No, sorry, I never hit a woman. So after about 5 minutes of me trying to get the pastor to agree that he had hit her in self-defense, the judge looks at me and says, Mr. Davis, you look like you need a break. And I said, yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am. I need a break. Yes, ma'am. And she said, all right, we're going to take a break. And she says, jury, all rise. And so the jury all stood up. And all of the jurors started walking out of the courtroom. And one lady juror, who I remember being from Louisiana, and I remember telling stories in voir dire, because I'm from Louisiana, and I remember telling a story in voir dire about Louisiana and finding out about her from being from Louisiana. And she was an older lady as well. She had to have been in her late 50s or so, And so she's walking past the witness box, and she stops right in front of the pastor and goes up to him and taps him on the arm and says, now you behave here. You behave. Now you behave here. And then she just files out of the courtroom with the other jurors. And I thought to myself, man, we got to get to closing argument as quickly as possible. And so the pastor, when the jury came back in, I asked the pastor a couple of follow-up questions and then passed him as a witness. And then the next witness we put on was his daughter, who established a few facts real quickly. And then we got to closing argument. And in closing argument, before closing argument, the judge was to give us a jury instruction. And when we got down to the charge, now my whole voir dire, for the most part, was based on self-defense. My voir dire was self-defense and a few other issues as well for self-defense. So we get to the charge conference with the judge, and I request an instruction on self-defense. And the judge says, no, Mr. Davis, you don't get that for self-defense. He says he never hit her. And I said, well, judge, the evidence seems to suggest that maybe he did her. He says, no, Mr. Davis, the defendant can't have his cake and eat it too. He says he didn't hit her, and so there's no self-defense. So we did not get a self-defense instruction. So here I was trying a self-defense case, trying to pick a jury that was a self-defense jury, and we don't get a self-defense instruction. So I'm feeling defeated, and I get to close an argument, and I remember a situation that happened, and I started my closing arguments with the words, butter beans and cucumbers. Butter beans and cucumbers. And I said, have we strayed so far from the path? They hosed him down like a dog. And I remember the story. I remember the story from my life. I remember when I was a kid that we had a neighbor, an older man, that lived in behind my dad named Mr. Goodwin. Now, Mr. Goodwin was a mean man. He was mean as a rattlesnake. And, he was a guy that all the kids in the neighborhood hated. We did not like Mr. Goodwin. He had to have been in the 70s or so, and he lived in the house behind my dad along with his wife. If we ever were playing baseball and we hit the ball and it went into Mr. Goodwin's yard, Mr. Goodwin would get the ball and keep the ball. If we were throwing our football around and somehow it went into his yard, he'd get our football and keep the ball. He wouldn't give any of our stuff back. If we ever went in his yard, he threatened to shoot us. He threatened to harm us. He threatened to hurt us. He was a rascal of an old man. And I remember one day sitting in my house, and my dad grew butter beans as well. And the fence that bordered our house and Mr. Goodwin's yard, he grew butter beans that grew up onto the fence. And they covered that back fence. And I remember one day sitting in a den, which was the last room in our house. And I remember looking out of the window and seeing Mr. Goodwin with a bowl picking my daddy's butter beans. So I went running to my dad and said, Daddy, Mr. Goodwin picking your butter beans. Come on, Dad, come on. So my dad goes back and he peeks out of the window. And he looks out and he sees Mr. Goodwin picking the butter beans, because I look out at another window below him and see it happening while he's looking out. He closes the window blind, closes the curtain, and then he turns to me and said, "Hmm." And I say, "Hmm? That's all you're going to say? He's picking your butter beans. That's all you're going to say is, hmm?" The very next day, my dad took me down into the garden. In our garden, you see, on that fence that bordered Mr. Goodwin, the butter beans bordered his house. But on the fence that was on the side that Mr. Goodwin couldn't get to, my dad grew cucumbers. And there were cucumbers growing all over in that area. So he and I went down in the garden with a huge grocery bag, a brown paper bag. And we filled that bag up with cucumbers. And he turned to me, and with the cucumbers in his hand, the bag of cucumbers in his hands, he thrust it to my chest and told me, "Take that to Mr. Goodwin and tell him if he needs some more, just to come on in and get some." And I argued to the jury after telling that story, have we strayed so far from the path? Wasn't there a time when we had weaker people, older people in our neighborhood and in our community that we cared for them and we took care of them? And we looked past any of their idiosyncrasies, and we attributed to their age, and we still honored them and cared for them, and we gave them cucumbers and butter beans. Butter beans and cucumbers. Have we strayed so far from the path? And that was the focal point of my argument. And I argued to the jury that they should find him not guilty. And the jury deliberated less than 5 minutes and found him not guilty. And it was a case that had a profound impact on me, because here it was, I was setting out with a defense. And because of the Holy Spirit, in terms of my client not wanting to go with that defense or eliminating all the jurors who were in favor of that defense, he ended up getting acquitted.
So what was the impact on you?
Oh, I learned, man. I learned that the jury had the power. The jury had the power. And that well-meaning people, people who were in tune, and people who were well-meaning would do the right thing. And so when I'm setting out to pick a jury, I'm not always caught up with a person's race. I'm not always caught up with a person's age. I'm not always caught up with the exterior of a person. I'm trying to find out about whether or not they are a well-meaning person. And if I can get to someone who's a well-meaning person, I know they'll do the right thing. Because that jury saw my client and saw the injustice of the situation, and they did the right thing. It was a situation where we achieved jury nullification, because we didn't really have a legal defense. I mean, she had whelps all over her face. The client denied hitting her. And the jury thought, hey, there's some reasonable doubt about whether or not he hit her. Even though she testified he hit her, and she had the bruises and everything to support that as well. You follow me? And so I took away from that, that if I can get some well-meaning people on a jury, and by that, people who have a sense of justice, people who know right from wrong, that they'll do the right thing in the case.
What's your proudest moment as a trial lawyer?
My proudest moment as a trial lawyer? This was one of them. I've had the opportunity to try murder cases, and I've secured acquittals in multiple murder cases. I've even tried federal cases, large federal conspiracies, and secured acquittals in those cases. But this case, representing the pastor, was one of my proudest moments, because it was a situation that I wasn't supposed to win. We weren't supposed to win. And we pulled back and we looked at the humanity of the situation, that this was just wrong on different levels. And the jury responded in kind. And I learned that as well with cases, that if you can find that element in a case where it's wrong, and you can find an element in a case that'll connect with a jury, that you can move mountains, that you can do many different things in a case.
Tell me more about that.
I'll give you an example. I represented a woman who was accused of killing her husband. You know, she killed her husband. We argued it was self-defense. He had been shot in the back, and he had been shot in the back of the head. But the client had been abused by this man for years, and his abuse was extensive. We called more police officers in the case as witnesses than the state did. In other words, we called more witnesses that were police officers to talk about his bad conduct, all the bad stuff, than all of the witnesses that the prosecutors called in the case in its entirety. So when the jury saw all of the abuse that he had inflicted upon my client, even though he had been shot in the back of the head and in the back, they agreed with self-defense. And they found her not guilty of a murder charge in that case. And that was a situation where we had jurors who had a sense of justice, who knew that it was wrong to convict this woman after all she had been through and everything else as well. And given the facts that he was coming at her at the time, that he was killed as well.
Sounds like you trust the jury?
In a lot of cases, I do. We spend a lot of time trying to get a jury that we can trust.
Can you share with us how trusting the jury is important?
Well, trusting the jury can be important because the jury is the one with the power in the courtroom. No matter how hard you try, no matter what you do, the jury is the one that has the power. In other words, I've tried cases and I fumbled around and I made mistakes and I thought I did a terrible job, but the jury saw it. And then we went afterwards, they told me, they said, hey, look, you know, we know you were struggling with it, but we could see where you were headed and we could see what was right. So trusting the jury is important in the sense that the judge has a limited amount of power, can hamstring a lawyer, but the person who has the power over the verdict is the jury. They're the ultimate decision makers in the case. And they have the power. And if you can get them to realize that they have the power, not the lawyer, not the judge, but each individual juror, you'll end up with some hung juries in cases. You'll end up with acquittals in cases as a defense lawyer. You'll end up with plaintiff's verdicts as a plaintiff's lawyer as well.
What was your worst moment as a trial lawyer?
My worst moment was when I had lost a case. I lost a case and I felt ill-equipped to really defend the client well. I had an abusive judge, a judge who now no longer is a judge. But, you know, he's off the bench. But I lost that case and I wanted to quit and stop being a trial lawyer.
Can you tell me that story?
Oh, sure. I was defending a lady who was a jailer, and we fought the trial. She was accused. She was a jailer, and an inmate came into the jail and was abusive towards her in language. And the inmate ended up with a fractured skull. And the allegation was that my client had hit her in the head repeatedly, and it was some other jailers who had testified against my client. We went to trial, argued that it was reasonable doubt. The client was assertive that she had never struck the lady, that they were trying to subdue her. She came in combative and so forth. And then during the course of that, she may have fallen and hit her head on a wall. So we went to trial, and the jury was deadlocked on the client's case. They were deadlocked 6-6. And the judge we had held them over another day. So they deliberated a second day, and they still were deadlocked 6-6. He brought them back a third day. Then they were deadlocked 7-5. They sent out a note saying, we're hopelessly deadlocked. He gave them what we call a dynamite charge and brought them back yet another day, a fourth day. And on that fourth day, they went from 7-5 to 11-1 in favor of guilty. And then after maybe about 4 hours or so, they returned a guilty verdict. And, of course, the client was sentenced to probation, and the judge gave her jail time as a condition of probation. So here I had the single mother, my client was a single mother, who had to go to jail in a case I didn't believe that she was guilty on, and in a situation where we were totally unprepared for her to go to jail. And while she's in jail, who cares for her children? And I felt that that was all on me as her lawyer, that I was inadequate, that if I knew more or was better, that I should have won that case, is what I felt. And so I was ready to quit. I was on the courthouse steps crying. Here I am, a grown man. I was a grown man. And this was years ago. This was years ago, maybe about 15 years ago or so. But I was on the courthouse steps crying. And one of her family members came by and started talking to me. And I told her, you know, I can't do this anymore. I can't do this anymore. I need to give this up. I need to do something different. You know, if it wasn't for me, she would have gotten acquitted. But I wasn't good enough, and so I'm going to stop doing this and do something different. You know, I can't do this anymore. And he told me, he says, Mr. Davis, don't give up. Get better. Get better, Mr. Davis. Don't give up. Get better. He says, you're one of the few lawyers that genuinely cares about the client. We see how you care about her. We see about how you approach this case. We see how hard you worked on it. And you fought. You were fighting. You were doing the best you could. We saw that. So don't give up. Just get better. Do everything you can to try to get better. We need more lawyers like you. And that encouraged me. It spoke to my soul. And I took it to heart. And I started to look for every opportunity I had to get better. To get better. And I ended up one day getting an email. I don't know how they got my information, but I got an email from the Trial Lawyers College. This was years ago. So I went to a regional. The email was about a regional from an organization called the Trial Lawyers College. And so I went to a regional in California. And at that regional, I saw people who were like-minded. And I learned about some different methods, some different techniques that were unique that I had never seen before. and it intrigued me. And they talked about this 3-week-long college in Wyoming. And I thought to myself, I said, man, 3 weeks is a long time. I don't know if I can get away from my practice that long. But I looked into it a little more and found out who all the lawyers were that went to the college and about how they had experienced success. And so I applied to the college. And I went to the 3-week program and graduated. And I left feeling energized. I left the college feeling as if I had some more tools for my toolbox, some more arrows in my quiver, some more weapons in my arsenal. I left feeling equipped, and I also left feeling better as a human being, too. And I realized that I needed to take care of myself as a human being. And I felt better equipped as a storyteller as well. And I tried cases after that. I think I won like several cases immediately after the college and experienced a great deal of success in my practice. And my practice grew, and I haven't looked back since.
How do you deal with seeing the misery and the pain and the mental illness being a public defender that you deal with every day?
Now, that's a good question, Scott. I'll tell you, it's hard. A lot of times I have to take steps back. Sometimes I even have to take a day off every now and then. I see a lot of pain, a lot of misery, and I like to say it doesn't affect me, but it still does affect me. You know, I try to keep balance. I try to keep reminding myself that I'm a litigator and not a litigant, that I'm the voice for people. You know, on the side, one of the things that we have that no other profession can claim, one of the things that we as lawyers have that's a sacred and a beautiful thing that we have the ability to do that nobody else, doctors can't say they do it, architects can't say they do it, engineers can't say they do it. We're the only category of professionals that can represent individuals in court. We're the only category of professionals that can go to court and actually stand in the shoes of somebody in court. And I came to a realization, even though I'm dealing with a lot of painful stuff and a lot of misery that people experience, that if I, as their advocate, am too caught up in the misery, I'm really no good to them. I'm the litigator, not the litigant. I'm not the one that suffered and hurt. I feel their pain, and I have to communicate their pain. But if I get caught up in their pain and I get buried in their pain, then I'm no good to them as a litigator.
That sounds like a sort of a contradiction in that you've got to feel their pain to communicate it, but not feel it too much so you go crazy.
That's right. That's why you've got to strike that balance. Got to strike that balance. And I had to come to that realization. It happened to me because I saw an older lawyer. I was in the trial. I was in the middle of a trial, and it was a hot, contested trial. And an older lawyer who had been watching the trial came up to me and said, "You got to realize or remember that you are the litigator, not the litigant. Don't get too caught up into it. You got to keep a cool head," is what he told me, because I was getting fired up at a bad ruling that we'd received. And I took that to heart, and I got an acquittal. And that was in the murder case that he came up and talked to me. And we ended up getting an acquittal in that murder case as well. It's a double homicide, alleged double homicide, that we got an acquittal in. And I took those words to heart, and I keep that with me now. I know I've got to feel for my clients, because I do. But I gotta, if I don't keep a level head as their advocate, as the person who stands in their shoes in court, then they're doomed.
I know you've got 4 beautiful children. And when they were, let's say, in kindergarten, what was the advice or words of wisdom that were most important to you to share with your kids?
That are still to this day, live life with no regrets, basically. I communicate that to them as often as I can, to live life without regret. I mean, you're always going to have some regret, but if you live life with the mindset that I don't want to have any regrets, then you'll live life to the fullest.
Eric, thank you so much for being here. I'm very proud to know you. You're a wonderful lawyer. You do wonderful work. You're a great trial lawyer, a great human being. Thank you so much.
Thank you for the opportunity, Scott.
Thank you for joining us today for Trial Lawyer Talk. If you like the show, I'd really appreciate it if you could give us a good review on iTunes, and I'd love to get your feedback. You can reach me at www.scottglovsky.com. That's SCOTTGLOVSKY.com. And I'd love to hear your feedback. You can also check out the book that I published called Fighting Health Insurance Denials, A Primer for Lawyers. That's on Amazon. I put the book together based on 20 years of suing health insurance companies for denying medical care to people, and it provides a general outline of how to fight health insurance denials. Have a great week, and we'll talk to you in the next episode.